Elise Hugh, welcome to Untangled.
Thank you. It's a delight to be here.
So your book, Flawless: Lessons in Looks and Culture from the K Beauty Capital, is about Korean beauty culture and more broadly how beauty culture is entangled with social norms, power, technology.
Yeah.
And in the book, you describe a cultural shift from an external male judging gaze to a self-policing, narcissistic gaze. Talk a bit about that shift and how technology is entangled in it.
There was a book, I think, in the 90s that came out that sold a million copies or something when it came out by Naomi Wolf, and it's called The Beauty Myth. And I think at that time, she was really the first to at least put in a comprehensive book this notion that so many women are sort of forced to objectify ourselves or forced to perform beauty for the eyes of men who control every lever of power in society, professionally, politically, economically, et cetera, et cetera. And so the male gaze came up again and again, as it had in women's and gender studies for a long time, as kind of the way women are expected to perform for men in patriarchies. And I think that now we have a far more complex, souped up situation in which the male gaze is remixed and evolved into an algorithmic or a technological gaze. And the way I would define it is the way that we are expected to perform for algorithms, or the way that we are now learning to perform for machines. It's formed with an algorithmically determined set of ideal traits for our body parts. And it could be for skin also, like skin smoothness and skin hairlessness. It represents this power shift away from this external male gaze, when we talk about the male gaze, to a more self-policing and narcissistic gaze that we sort of force on ourselves.
I mean, this gets a little bit to the Marxian idea of false consciousness that you note in your book, says that sort of under the right exploitative conditions, people will unconsciously go along with value systems that don't serve them. And you push back on the idea and argue that even though today's beauty standards are unattainable and totally unrealistic, that women aren't being deluded into wanting to meet them, that in many ways it's a rational choice in pursuit of economic empowerment and belonging.
Yeah, there are real rewards,
yeah,
right? There is a pretty privilege in society.
Right.
And so I don't know that we are duped into it. We could be, and I think many South Korean women that I interviewed would say, you know, in this kind of system, of course I would want to advantage myself and live a better life, because a better life is tied to playing the part and fitting into the beauty standards of the day.
Well, I mean, I'm curious how this has played out in your own life, and maybe how these conditions encourage the kind of appearance labor you talk about in the book.
Yeah, so what I saw in South Korea is something that then helped me look at my own life and maybe recast some of my memories in my own relationship with my mother, who is an Asian mom. I am not Korean, but I'm Taiwanese American. So also my mother comes from East Asia, and there are similar values, like having really clear and light, fair skin, for example. You know, that's always been a marker of status in Northeast Asia, because it meant that your people were out working the fields. You didn't have an agrarian life. And so I feel like there are kind of two big takeaways for me as I was researching the book and then looking deeper into myself. And it's that I had to reckon with how good looks, or having good looks, is framed as a matter of personal responsibility. And that if you fail, it's somehow a personal failing. And then mothers are kind of held responsible for their children's weight that gets coded as maternal love. And that made me really think about my mom saying, like, when I was a teenager, oh, you're at a perfect weight now. You know, like that I wasn't too fat and I wasn't too skinny, and that there was an ideal. And I think that my mom really thought of that as part of her responsibility to make sure that I did get the privileges of a life that afforded a kind of halo effect to those who are considered attractive. It's kind of painful now, actually, to think about, because it means that had I not been the perfect weight, then would I have been less worthy in my mother's eyes.
I mean, how do you think that sort of shaped your relationship with your mom?
Oh, wow, you're really putting me on the couch. Actually, you know, it's
Curious.
really interesting that you asked me this because I feel like after I got through the journey of writing and researching and reporting this book, which took about 3 years, it has helped me see my mother in a lot more in a lot more complex and complicated light than I did before. I think that I always just sort of bought my mom's line, like, oh, you have the best mom. Your mom is so loving. Your mom is so nurturing. I've sacrificed so much for you, et cetera, et cetera. And I was always just like, God, I'm so close with my mom. It's awesome. And But then the more I observed the relationship between Korean moms and their daughters, and then the way that they cloaked sort of encouraging their daughters to change their appearance. In South Korea, you would often gift plastic surgery or plastic surgery gift certificates to your high school graduates, for example, as they're graduating, because you want to give your kids the good life. And the good life means at least meeting a minimum bar of appearance. And so the more I saw this in South Korea, I saw it sort of reflected in my own life in the ways that my mom would say, you know, you need to look ladylike, you need to be presentable, like your skirt is too short, fix your hair before you leave the house. And my mother is awesome. I do think of her situation and the reason why she had to teach these things to me as coming from a much more limited set of options, right? Because she is a baby boomer, a late baby boomer. And so, like, women, because they needed to, there were fewer paths for women besides kind of entering the marriage market. There was that sort of social pressure. And I think that now we can let ourselves go more and be kinder to ourselves. And I am having to sort of reckon with the privilege that is assumed by attractiveness, but also all of the lack, the stigma of lack of attractiveness or lack of thinness or whatever it is that marginalizes you because you don't meet the certain standard of the day.
I mean, thank you for sharing that about your mom. It makes me think of how if I had internalized that we're all sort of doing the best that we can with what we had at the time, it would have saved me a lot of hours in therapy. Well, so in some ways, it feels like we could situate the conversation you're describing in nearly any country or cultural context, and it would feel familiar, you know, like capitalism is alive and well in most places. The patriarchy is alive and well. Social comparison, you know, was alive and well before social media came along and turbocharged it. But you're writing about the Korean beauty industry, and you argue that Korean beauty culture is one of the most extreme in the world, and that its hypermodernity offers the rest of us a kind of glimpse around the corner, that Korea is basically doing what everyone will be doing soon. So I'm curious if you could talk a bit about your experience of beauty standards in Korea and what feels sort of hyper modern about it.
What feels most hyper modern about it is the solutionism and the notion of optimization and the notion that there is a correct way to look, that there are the right ratios, there are the right shades of skin to be. Korea is very didactic about, and obviously, this is an overgeneralization. It's not all Koreans, and I want to be really careful to talk about that and to make that point. But in general, Korean culture in the mid tens, as I was living it, was very didactic about what good looks meant and how you were supposed to look. And a lot of it came out of diagnostic technologies like skin analysis, like measuring your face for certain ratios when you went to dermatology or plastic surgery clinics. And so it was the solutions that were being offered for perceived flaws that you might not previously know you had, that I really saw different in South Korea than, say, in the United States. The other thing about South Korea is that 97% of South Korea is ethnically Korean. And so there really isn't that much diversity when it comes to, say, hair color or height. And it allowed for phenomenons like free size, which is the one size of clothing in clothing stores that I would run into again and again, because there's so many Koreans could fit that one size of clothing that they didn't need to offer a bunch of different sizes. I guess it works the same way for very exclusive boutiques, right? That only stock sample sizes, because really only models wear those clothes. Except I found that in society at large. When we keep returning to beauty culture, so just for definitions here, when I say beauty culture, I describe it as diet culture's fraternal twin. This system of beliefs that defines beauty a certain way, and it usually is an adherence to current societal appearance standards, right? And those standards can largely be shaped by forces like capitalism that you bring up and patriarchy. And in a beauty culture, you're really upholding physical appearance as a form of political and economic, and as we're talking about, social capital. And I think when you're trying to wring the most out of an asset, in this case, humans, you can get pretty prescriptive about how to do it. And so in South Korea, what I found was kind of the prescription, the definition of problems that maybe you didn't have, but then also this bevy of solutions. South Korea has the most sophisticated, mature, and saturated cosmetic surgery market in the world, four times as many plastic surgeons per capita than the United States. And they're
Whoa.
constantly having to compete with one another, right? And innovate and come up with new procedures, new solutions to perceived problems, and then new ways to diagnose those problems. So you have the most advanced, like 3D imaging for your face and analysis for your sculpt. Your skull and how the curvature of your skull, and maybe you might need to get your skull reshaped because you have this the shape is wrong according to all of their analysis, their meta-analyses of beauty and what is considered most beautiful. And so again and again, you have this solutionism, the supply of solutions driving demand for fixing the body. And that's where I thought, gosh, South Korea is at least 5, maybe 10 years ahead of the rest of us. And crucially, all of this is far more accessible because of the oversupply of surgeons and the oversupply of solutions. The price point is also lower.
The solutionism line makes me think a lot about our current sort of tech world and
Exactly.
how
Yes.
we, before we can sort of like decide on what the actual problem is, we've already come up with a technology to try and quote unquote solve for it. And then we fall into a pattern where we try on that new solution and it turns out we were wrong about the problem in the first place. It was far more complex. It was
And
entangled in
this was bad
structural
for us, and the
issues.
solution was harmful. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, did you find yourself just sort of like living in parallel worlds in studying this in the context of beauty culture?
I feel like all my thoughts are still like only three quarters of the way baked. Like my brain, all these ideas are sort of those like really mushy brownies. And so I continue to think about this stuff all the time, but Flawless, it came out just a couple months ago, and again it gets described as like a book about K-beauty, but I really think of the book as a book about technology and the way that we and like what is the nature of abuse and what is the nature of exploitation, because we have been talking about the technological gaze a lot, and I think that if this algorithmic gaze becomes dominant, our bodies are essentially projects to be
Yeah,
worked on, right?
be made more
Forever.
efficient somehow.
Yes. The standards of beauty could be constantly intensified and the bar of perfection continually raised. It's this appearance improvement arms race. And that's what I'm seeing in South Korea. And that is so like alarming and worth interrogating.
Yeah, like the original sin is that like the body was something to be measured, or that the body was something to be optimized for.
And what have we seen? You know this better than me, Charlie, but obviously There are so many examples of pseudo progress when it comes to technology and wanting to barrel towards optimization, right?
Right.
But what are the conditions that have been created by this kind of pursuit?
I think that it creates a sort of false sense of progress. Like we get to believe that we're, creating all these new tools and solving problems, and then in its wake, we leave deepening inequality, right? Like we forget that actually technology is downstream from all of these sort of structural things you describe in the book, and that like the application of technology to a problem that's like, embedded in race relations and embedded in financial incentives and embedded in cultural norms, that we often make those things worse. And
Totally.
that many of the problems actually require shifts in culture or shifts in policy or shifts in law, not a new technology.
Yeah, in a macro way, you see a lot of mass inequality. I think in the micro way, and something that I come to by the end of the book, is this notion of alienation that a lot of this has created, that we become these atoms that are more and more separated from one another, and that pursuing, when you're trying to wring the most out of yourself as an asset, then you're really focusing on yourself as an individual and more of a zero-sum game with everybody else and a lot of comparison and competition. It is no wonder that films like Parasite, that are critiques of capitalism and inequality, that television shows like Squid Game are coming out of Korea and Korean conditions and from Korean auteurs. And I think that this is something that is reflected in beauty, and we're talking about beauty right now, but the bigger ideas and the bigger forces touch sort of every sphere of life.
I mean, your book does an incredible job of describing these big systemic forces that shape how technology and beauty culture interact. But as you note earlier, you were principally writing about social media. And since the book was published, we've seen, the release of our AI-based overlords that, in the context of what we're talking about, produce synthetic images. If you were starting to write Flawless now with AI at the center, how do you think the book would be different, if at all?
We tend to give more authority to AI than maybe social algorithms, or we've come to understand social algorithms more over the last 5, 10 years. And right now, it's such a wild, wild west for what's actually happening when it comes to these how AI images are generated, that I feel like it's just kind of the unknown TikTok algorithms, but on steroids. And in the bigger picture, I worry about the way that these images, and you've written about this, you wrote about it really well in your Substack, that these are inaccurate pictures of reality, right? And the images tend to erase difference between all of us, right? You're promoting more attractive versions of ourselves, but these more attractive versions are all based on these machine-driven assumptions of what's beautiful in the first place, and that is creating this norm that erases difference. It erases the diversity of the human experience, and that really stresses me out.
Yeah, it's stressful and it's just going to get weirder and weirder. I mean, you talk about it erasing difference. There's a couple of tools, software firms like La La Land and Deep Agency that were started around this purpose, and basically, they will train one of these image generators on real people's images and then create synthetic images of people of different races from their perspective in the spirit of improving representation and diversity and inclusion in the modeling business. And then of course sell those images to companies like Levi that are actually using these images in their campaigns and their marketing campaigns. And it's so striking to me. It feels like such a kind of an like nutty sentiment that like representation that exists in digital only could possibly be representation, that like using the images of real people and like profiting off of them to create synthetic images is sort of where we've arrived at as like our pathway towards like diversity, equity, inclusion. It just seems bonkers.
Do you think the next big thing, do you think that everything will just return to where it started and the next big thing will be like, let's just take pictures of real people?
That'd be
Just like
cool. There will be an app
actual.
for it.
I actually don't know where I would start now because if I were to start to answer your original question, I don't know how, where I would start today. I just know that it sort of stresses me out and it's so mystifying that even the people who created AI tools don't exactly know how AI works at this point. I heard that Ted Chiang, who is the short story writer, the science
Yep.
fiction short story writer, had a really good take on what he's concerned about in a recent Vanity Fair. So I haven't read it yet, but I'm really looking forward to doing that.
Well, as anyone who's read my little newsletter, they will be familiar with Ted Chiang. He's one of my favorite writers on AI these days. When
Oh, have you
he
read his interview in Vanity Fair? Apparently he like decided to open up and talk about his concerns.
Oh,
But
cool. No, I haven't.
it's not what we think.
Interesting. All right, I'll check it out. When he wrote his piece for The New Yorker that likened artificial intelligence to management consulting firms, and sort of wanted to create the metaphor around like McKinsey and Company, as like how we should think about AI, that's when I fell in love with Ted Chiang. Another variable that is always changing is the culture around technology, how we use it, how we think about it, how we orient ourselves to it, which brings me to a great piece in Wired that you shared with me by Charlotte Shane called, quote, "Face Forward: The Unpredictable Magic of TikTok and Instagram Beauty Filters is that they make you feel more like you." And so in it, Shane writes about her relationship to augmented filters as one that feels like play and self-exploration. It's actually a very optimistic piece, I thought, that reminds us that we can use technology in ways that express our curiosity, inspire others, make ourselves laugh, explore a new identity. I'm curious, what did you take away from the piece?
Yeah, I loved that reminder. I just don't want to be black and white about these things because they are so complex and there are so many paradoxes when it comes to our appearance or appearance labor, right? Like what is considered expression and fun for one person can be a crutch and a hamster wheel for another.
Right.
And so I don't want to get into a situation in which we're judging one another because that's exactly where we don't want to be, where we're sort of individualistic about our how we adorn ourselves. And so it was a fun reminder to me that like when I watch my 6-year-old play with filters on Snapchat, she loves to use Snapchat. And she loves to use Snapchat because she loves to like turn her face into a crazy goblin or a
Yeah.
wolverine and just like really dress up. I don't know that becoming some sort of scary goblin is making my 6-year-old feel more like her. It really is just like exploration and
Yeah.
play. And so I think that I just really liked that piece because it was not one of the umpteenth doomsaying pieces about filters. Because I think that we know that and we understand it, and we should try and kind of make to kind of complicate the argument and argue against like amongst ourselves and against our own selves to try and figure out a place that we can land. What I'm worried about is when the majority of beauty filters, especially for people who are not children, like when we're getting into the teenage years, adolescent years and beyond, is that they are promoting the same general standards of what is
Right.
considered more attractive. Like when you can't opt into it, when it's automatic, like Zoom, touch up my appearance. The way it touches up our appearance is upholding various sort of pillars of beauty and appearance standards, right? Like smoothness, it automatically smooths your skin. So it presupposes that having smooth skin is better than not having smooth skin. So there is a good skin and a bad skin. It is, in many cases, I think that it's like I don't know if it's with Zoom, but I know that there was one app that I was trying out where I noticed that my cheeks were thinner, like my jawline was narrowed. And so that presupposes it's better to not have like a double chin or to have a skinnier face or a less wide jaw. And so I think that it's not like the play filters that I'm worried about. And I do appreciate that we get to play, on filters, and that these can eat up a lot of our time and occupy my 6-year-old. I just the ones that I worry about is that the vast majority of filters that we use as adults are ones that adhere to very normalized standards for how we define beauty. What did you take away?
Like, it reminded me of why everyone fell in love with the internet to begin with. Like, it was a
Yeah.
place where
It
you
was
could
weird.
explore. It was weird. You could explore new identities. It was a form of play at some level. And your response makes me just think about how unable we are to talk about technology, or make sense of it. Like, 10 years ago, technology was only a solution. It was only a good thing. We were going to connect the world. It was, we know that line of thinking, but now it feels like we've gone 180 degrees in the other direction where tech is only bad. But I mean, one way in which there's nuance in these conversations is like the sort of small differences in the sort of technological affordances themselves. And so Shane in her piece is writing about filters, and that is something that encourages a kind of play and exploration. It allows for a little bit more agency and choice on our part. You're describing a dynamic in the book wherein sort of cultural norms and algorithmic systems converge such that appearance labor is, quote, both a choice and not a choice.
Oh, yep, that line.
Yeah, that line's, I underlined it. It really stuck with me. And what I wanted to raise is, like, the problem with systems that are both a choice and not a choice is that they're really hard to change, because we get something out of participating in them, which in turn sort of like sustains the system. Where so we can't just create new systems. We have to sort of change the norms and ways of thinking that the sort of underlying systems inculcate. And towards the end of your book, you offer three ideas to sort of like help us turn the corner collectively around embodiment, mutuality, and worthiness. What might it look like to be more embodied or practice mutuality?
I go back to what Audre Lorde originally defined self-care as, and now self-care is about like bubble baths and healing crystals and the wellness industry. Like, big wellness has taken over self-care as a term, such that it doesn't really mean anything anymore. But originally, under Audre Lorde, self-care was a fight for self-preservation and expression. And so we actually need practices to keep us in touch with our own agency that you talk about, because these big systems can make us feel helpless, they can make us feel powerless. So the work is to hold on to our own agency, to sort of take in and be accountable and realistic about our own places of privilege, right? And it's not, because I think so often one of the reasons why we don't change or we don't act different individually is because we want to hold on to our own privilege. And we can implement some changes. When you say, like, what does it mean to practice mutuality? I think we can implement some changes in our own relationships and our workplaces, and that can lead to larger change. Like, individual change can inspire other women, that can give permission to other women, like in my community of moms, for example, to also make internal shifts, this embodiment and this mutuality that we're talking about. And it can put pressure on the larger system. So I feel like systems can't change without a critical mass of individuals taking stock and acting different. I do not think, when we talk about this question of like what's the relationship between personal change and societal change, I do not think the onus needs to be on the individual But I do think that we can inspire one another, and that is kind of the nature of mutuality, right? That we can give permission, we can give license to one another to let our hair go gray, for example, which has happened at post-COVID. More and more women are just wearing their hair gray, which you didn't see as much before this big pandemic and this societal shift, and women's sort of realizing, wait, I don't need to do this labor. And the more your friends allow for their hair to go undyed, the more you feel a license to do so. That's just like one tiny example. Having body hair is another. I remember just talking to my coworker at my podcast company a few weeks ago, where now she's wearing, or now she's not shaving her armpits. Somebody asked her about it, and she's like, "Yeah, it's just hair," you know. And it's like these little changes, or resisting Botox, showing up without makeup, not photo, like not prettifying your photos. Like, there's all these little things that we can do that can be more embodied for us. It can give ourselves a break, that can also give license and permission and inspiration to other people.
It's so clear in the book that individual actions doesn't get us where we want to go, but they can inspire collective action. You wrote a line, winning through self-optimization in a hyper-capitalist system is a precarious way of life for those at the top, and that it relies on the aspirations of the underprivileged to give it power. And I just thought that was so true and sort of points to the importance of what you're saying, that we have to connect our individual actions to collective action.
I write about how if I went and got Botox, because I'm now 41 and I have creases in my forehead. If I went and got Botox, it might alleviate anxiety for me individually, because I might be like, oh, I look better, I look younger, or whatever it's supposed to do for you. And maybe I have less anxiety or angst about aging when I look in the mirror because I did that thing. But it's not helpful to all of the other moms in my friend group who are the same age, because then it increases the pressure that we're all creaseless, or that everybody else will kind of do it. And then if everybody else does it and spends the money and the time and energy, because let's not pretend that these things are cost free, then it normalizes this notion that a 41-year-old should have a creaseless forehead. And so you're creating a new norm that everybody is going to have to chase. And then there are those who are underprivileged who would never be able to afford doing this, participating in this practice. And what, they're just old now, or they look old. What ends up happening is that conventional beauty equals conventional wealth. And those who can't keep up are just considered less worthy. What, because they're poor? And this exacerbates the problem of inequality. So I know I am not coming down on anybody who does choose Botox. I'm just saying that I personally, this is like the way I'm thinking about it now, that I never did before.
Towards the end of the book, you write, quote, "If you ask me what my dream is, it's not for everyone to believe they're beautiful, but instead to believe they are worthy, flaws included," end quote. Now, I own every Brené Brown book there is, so I'm on board for the worthiness revolution. So maybe let's end
Saint
it with
Brené, my
Saint
fellow
Brené.
Texan.
Oh my God, that's a whole other podcast, but I'm down for it. But I'm curious what lessons have you learned on your own journey to being flawed and worthy?
I've learned to let myself off the hook. I've learned to be kinder to myself. And something that Brené talks about, actually, or something that really unlocked things for me, is this notion that your connection and how connected you can feel to other people is only ever as strong as how connected you are with yourself. And that meant, and it always seems sort of selfish to me to really look into my interiority, or spend a bunch of time in therapy for those who can afford it. Like, it sounds, I think, or sounded to me like counterintuitive to be kinder to myself, and to extend myself a lot of compassion. But I have found that the kinder I am to myself, the more compassion that I have had in my relationships and in my workplace, and just with the wider community of humans that we share this earth with. And so I have softened my internal narratives. And then I have really tried my best to teach diversity and difference to my kids, That has been a huge takeaway, I think, in this journey of better understanding myself and my relationship with beauty and the role that it plays. It's that, my notion of beautiful really came from whatever media was teaching me in the 1990s as we were coming up. And so my notion of thin was like so much more extremely thin than it should have been, because I came up during Ally McBeal and Kate Moss. And that then led me to an angsty relationship with my body for a long time. And so a big part of the worthiness revolution is to challenge your own narrative and to identify your values. But the big takeaway, I think, was just to learn to be kinder to myself, and that has really redounded everywhere else in my life.
Well, that's a great place to end it. Elise Hu, thanks so much for coming on Untangled.
Thank you, Charlie. It was great.